Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, a host of the Public Policy Channel, and today we are speaking with Jay Bainbridge and Tamaru Mamo, who are the co-authors, along with Linda Gibbs and Muzzy Rosenblatt, of How 10 Global Cities Take on Homelessness, Innovations That Work, new out from the University of California Press. Jay, Tamaru, welcome. Welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So if you would, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourselves and perhaps your co-authors and how you all came to work together on this book?
Thanks. I'll start. I'm Jay Bainbridge. I'm an associate professor of public administration at Marist College, which is in the Hudson Valley, and also a former assistant commissioner for policy and planning at the New York City Department of Homeless Services, where I worked for about 6 or 7 years. Since I left the city for academia, I've been consulting with Bloomberg Associates on international city homelessness initiatives.
And hi, I'm Tamaru Mamo, and I work for Bloomberg Associates, which is a pro bono consulting firm that works with the mayors of cities, and I work in the social services practice. And I spent several years as a health advisor to Mayor Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York City. And then I worked for a couple of years for the New York City public hospital system called Health and Hospitals. And I was the chief of staff to the president of the system. And then eventually I came to Bloomberg Associates. And I guess I'll introduce the other authors.
Terrific.
I can talk a little bit about them. And so Linda Gibbs is the quintessential public servant, 30 plus years in public service. She was a former New York City deputy mayor for Health and Human Services under Mayor Bloomberg. And then she also works at Bloomberg Associates. She's the principal of the social services practice. And we work on a variety of issues within that practice, everything from poverty to disparities to homelessness, which comes up a lot and obviously we'll be discussing. And Muzzy Rosenblatt is also a veteran of city service, several years, and he eventually transitioned into leadership of a non-government organization called BRC, which provides services across New York City, very large. So everything from street outreach to shelter services and housing. And if you see these bright orange vests on the New York City subway doing a street outreach, that's BRC because they handle the street outreach for all of the New York City subway system. So I have to say, you have a very we talk about 10 cities in the book, but we're very New York City biased as well. And I guess I should talk a little bit about how this book came about and how we and why.
Yeah, please.
We worked with these 10 cities. So I go back to the Bloomberg Associates role. So all of these authors have done work for us. Linda and I, this is our primary job. And then we've brought Jay and Muzzy in to do consulting work in a few of the cities. And we work with cities domestic and abroad. So we're, you know, I should list the cities in this book. They're very diverse. You know, Athens, Bogota, Mexico City, Paris, and we have Nashville, Houston, L.A., Baltimore, obviously New York City, and I think that's it.
Edmonton.
Edmonton, Canada. I forgot.
Poor Edmonton, always getting left out.
Edmonton's a very interesting city, and we could talk a little bit more about that later. But so why these cities, and how did this come about? So we had been working, Linda and I, and NJ and Muzzy had been working in several cities through Bloomberg Associates, and it was interesting to when we brought cities together, we would see how it was interesting to trade ideas, but the conversations that happened afterwards were sometimes even more interesting. Sure, they wanted to talk about their work and, you know, the impact it was having, but the conversations that happened after those official meetings were conversations about failure and conversations about frustrations and conversations about creative ideas that people wanted to try but weren't sure they can do, and so we thought, okay, what if we get everyone together, and we could, you know, they could bring their most innovative ideas, in some cases even provocative ideas, and present them to each other and get the unvarnished feedback and critique each other's ideas. And so we applied for a program set in Italy. It's sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation, and they have this amazing facility in Bellagio, Italy, where they allow people to hold conferences, and you could apply for this program, and we did, and we got in. And so we had all these people working in government, often in offices that aren't adequately heated or overcrowded, in this like luxurious kind of, you know, villa setting, where talking about homelessness. And but we cut them off from the outside world. No, don't bring your phones into these sessions. We're just going to talk about your ideas. And so that was an amazing process and a whole nother story. But at the end of this convening, one of our co-authors, Linda, she has this gift for being able to synthesize, you know, a whole lot of information. And she talked about the commonalities of the experiences of these different cities in, you know, trying to address the homelessness crisis. You can imagine the diversity of you know, structural government and politics and cultural perceptions about homelessness and just services and poverty in general and rights, etc. But she found a way to kind of synthesize these commonalities in a way that was so compelling that some of the cities said, you know, it would be interesting if you wrote a book about this. And
do you mind if I jump in, Cameron?
Yeah. And so I'll transition over to Jay.
So just to add to that, I think it was a big surprise for us, having worked in these cities that were so different, that there were so many commonalities. And we had been experiencing this as we were traveling and working in different places. But what was also surprising is how much the other cities, when they met with each other, were able to speak to each other and relate to each other and found the sort of even though their populations, as Tamara said, their cultures, their economic resources, the way their governments are structured, even the nature of homelessness in each place and their definitions were all unique from place to place, we found these common barriers. So, you know, whether it be low levels of national initiative, high and shifting needs, citizens who were both played dual roles, being both very critical of homelessness, but also wanting to help, and in all places, limited resources. And so when we brought everybody together, we found that in all these cities, to varying degrees of success, leaders were innovating in face of this overwhelming demand, and that we shared a common language and found we were able to learn from each other's successes and failures. And in the book, I think we're trying to tell the story of homelessness through the stories of these cities and their unique perspectives, but yet the commonalities that we see as threads throughout.
So why don't we stick with sort of the idea of commonalities? I do want to sort of turn us down the road to thinking about sort of what distinguishes certain kinds of cities from others. And if you would, have you think a little bit about causes, right? And the focus of the book looks at people who are experiencing homelessness more broadly, but a lot of the focus, it seems to me, is on people who are unsheltered, who are living in the street or in, yes, or in places that are not particularly designed for human habitation. Can you talk a little bit, maybe bounce back to you, Tamaru, and talk a little bit about, are there common causes? Is there something we can point to across all or most of these cities and say, this is why people wind up living in places that are not designed for human habitation?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And so, yeah, it's complicated. And so it's interesting about thinking about the commonalities of causes and also just the commonalities of the problem that cities face in addressing homelessness. And so, you know, I would say there's these terms. I hate using these technical terms, but, you know, some people use the term social exclusion, you know, a loss of social networks. And I think that's a commonality. And you know, there's often problems of, you know, challenges from mental illness and addiction that go along with these things, and it's sometimes tough to say, you know, what came first, you know, and why, and I think in the United States, and Jay can talk about this in much more depth, it's also you know, a lot of people who can't afford housing and really struggle financially. And it's easy to say poverty is the cause, but actually, you know, it's actually a rare group that moves from poverty to homelessness, and it's tough to predict who is actually going to move. It takes a lot to actually end up on the street, regardless of the fact that it's, you know, it's difficult for so many families in, you know, in the United States and outside the country to find affordable houses in cities. So affordability is a huge issue. But why people end up on the street is very complicated. So Jay, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, you want anything to that, Jay?
I'll just give it the bullet points. You know, I think it really runs the gamut, and the reasons are both structural, so racism and gentrification, you know, economic, like Tamaru said, rise in housing prices, low wage work and poverty. We've seen a lot of effect of immigration and migration that has led to encampments in many places. And then some of the support system, like healthcare, there's different levels of addressing healthcare needs, especially mental health needs across the cities, across the world. And then also somewhat of a changing roles of families. So, you know, more of a fractured social support system, maybe some domestic violence. So given that there's many really different causes, I think that's one of the reasons we think why the solutions have to be also dynamic and flexible and in some ways courageous.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So why don't we talk about some of those solutions? And maybe Tamaru again, we'll go back to you. Where do you think we should start as we think about maybe either what particular cities have in common or things that you think are particularly useful as we think about maybe models or approaches that could be adopted in other locales? When you think about what different cities are doing to resolve this, what are the things that jump out as you as the things that we should focus our attention on?
Sure. And so I think that the commonalities and what cities, some of the challenges that cities face and what they're doing about it is, because we're talking about cities, oftentimes the cities don't control, many of the services that could end up being solutions, they may not necessarily control the healthcare system to connect people to mental health care or other health care, and they may not have sufficient resources to build affordable housing and often, get resources from the federal government for whether it's public housing, vouchers or subsidies from the state. And so the cities don't control all the levers of these systems.
Some of those cities don't even control the shelter systems, right?
Absolutely.
Correct.
Yeah. Absolutely. So yeah, often the continuum of cares or the counties or sometimes, non-government organizations. But the mayors, here's the commonality, the mayors often get blamed and often people expect the mayors to come up with solutions. And so it's a very difficult task that some mayors, don't want to own because they feel they don't have sufficient resources or tools to address it. But here's a high level, I think important strategy is because the cities don't own it, they have to bring in many different stakeholders if they want to address it. And I think coming up with a structure where you have a trusted convener, a structure where you have, not just one person owning this, but everyone agreeing to play a role. And that's different levels of government. And that's people and that's providers and organizations outside of the government. So coming up with a system where you convene and have a governance structure to oversee strategies to address homelessness, that's a huge thing. Some would call it leadership. Someone's got to decide to do this. It can come from a mayor. And sometimes in cities like Edmonton, it actually comes from a nonprofit who decided just to convene people and work towards solutions. But the structure, the governance structure that you come up with for building and implementing and evaluating a strategy, that's really important too, because one thing I can tell you is mayors will turn over and homelessness will not be solved within one term. And so you need these continuing governance structures to oversee the long haul and the continuous work required to address homelessness. And in terms of strategies, it's easy to say housing, but we should say it. Again, not a resource that's completely controlled or even partially controlled by some cities. So building affordable housing, housing with supportive services as well, is really important. And engaging people who don't trust the government and who may not want to come in, finding a way to engage people in care, finding a way to engage people in case management and linking into affordable housing is really important. And then the prevention aspect. A lot of people think eviction prevention, but we can't even, it's hard to say how many people who are evicted even end up being homelessness. I know that it kind of sounds counterintuitive. Well, if you're evicted, you should end up on the street. Well, not necessarily. And so it's really complicated. So prevention work can range from predictive analytics, trying to use data to predict who will be homelessness and provide services to those families before they end up at the shelter door, before they, you know, end up on the street. And so that's an important component to preventive strategies. So I guess that's how I'd sum it up, Jay. I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
I think, yes, we talk about this as a systems level approach, and sometimes we even within our group, it's probably not a good use of terms, but we often say that homelessness as a topic itself doesn't always have a home. So as you said, sometimes the mayors don't even control the shelters. Those are often run by nonprofits. And at the national level as well, oftentimes national or local levels, homelessness is either an isolated agency or it's an agency within another agency. It's a department within another agency and doesn't have a lot of pull or strength. But to address the problem, it needs to be elevated to the level where it, as Tamara said, either at the mayoral level or a partner who has a lot of strength to be able to make something happen and see it through over the long term.
But I'm thinking of San Francisco, right? Which is a city that arguably has more of that sort of centralized, coordinated control at the city level than do lots of these other places. But is notorious, right, in the contemporary period in its inability to wrap its arms around what continues to be enormously large numbers of people experiencing homelessness in the city. And, you know, part of one of the common explanations for what interrupts the ability of the city to manage the problem is the disproportionate power and influence of wealthy property owners in particular, mm-hmm. that both get in the way of creating more affordable housing and get in the way of erecting shelters. Does that seem like a reasonable read of San Francisco to you? And do you see, and if you do think that's reasonable, do you see that dynamic playing out in other places with forces that really wind up being arguably at an even higher level than mayoral control? I don't know who wants to take a first bite at that.
I don't mind addressing it to start. And so, yeah, so affordability is certainly part of the challenge in San Francisco. And yes, it's tough for someone with a good job to find housing there. And the city does have control of many of the levers of resources. But it's interesting when I almost want to veer from San Francisco because I feel like when I think of the cities that we worked with in particular, and because I kind of want to highlight them, mm-hmm. who's had success, it's actually the cities with fewer resources and less control over the resources. Like Houston and Edmonton are perfect examples, and I mean Edmonton has very little investment at the city level. I think 3% of the municipal budget, something like that, and invested in addressing homelessness, and a lot from the provincial level, a little bit less from the federal level, and Houston also a very small contribution from the city. But what they've done is they've managed to cobble together the different stakeholders who do control the resources, including the private sector, to form these impressive collaborations and have impact. I mean, Houston, Houston, I think has had something along the lines of a 50% drop in street homelessness since 2011, And so it's one of the examples of best practices worldwide for addressing homelessness. And one would never guess this, you know, from the amount of resources that actually that the city invests and controls. And Edmonton, it's the same thing. It's a nonprofit overseeing the implementation of a strategic plan. And since, you know, I think it's since 2009, they've seen a 43% reduction in people experiencing homelessness. And again, you know, very small investment from the city. And so it's, you know, I would caution people not necessarily to make a link between the amount of resources and an effectiveness of a strategy. And that's why it's so complicated. And look at New York too. Like, I think Jake can talk about New York and the level of investment.
I want to make sure we get there. So Jake, why don't we talk about New York for a little bit?
Okay. Well, so New York is a city that has actually a very, you know, relatively low level of street homelessness compared to its population. So it ranks up with some of the better cities in the world with low levels of street homelessness, unlike, say, as you mentioned, San Francisco or Los Angeles, which might be one of the cities that has the highest concentrations of street homelessness in the world. And so New York's story is a little different. It has a right to shelter. That means anybody who comes and shows up and can demonstrate they have no place to stay will be guaranteed a shelter in New York. And so relatively speaking, there are fewer people living on the street, still far too many. But the big story in New York really is around shelter and homelessness, and probably a story around homelessness that most people don't realize, which is it's largely families, not single
individuals.
Overwhelmingly
families, right?
It is, yes. Yeah. And so if you look at what is the most common age group in shelters in New York City, it's 0 to 5.
Yeah.
And so that's something that people maybe don't understand because it's not as visible. So our book is focused, as you said, on the street homeless, more the visible part of homelessness. Shelters are a part of the solution, and having ways to bring people off the street, especially in what we would call low demand settings. So one of the things that New York City has innovated with is something they called safe havens, which allow people to come in to an environment that has less rules. The shelters tend to have more rules, and allows them to stay and be able to go in and out of the facility without losing their bed and having a little bit lower level of demands on the people that are there. And this has been a very successful approach in New York City to get people who are sort of the worst street homeless in for a while, and then giving them some services and eventually moving them into housing.
And Jay, what is the...
Sorry, go ahead.
Wait, Jay, what is it? Remind me what the budget is, approximate budget for New York City's continuum of care.
It's more than the continuum of care is relatively low, but the New York City itself is very unusual in that the city invests high amounts of its taxpayers' money into homelessness.
So you were talking about the safe haven model, which is primarily run by BRC, if I remember correct, right? Which is led by one of your co-authors, Mussie Rosenblatt. Is that right?
That is right. They were one of the starters, but it's now spread all over the place.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have vague memories back in the day of when that was spinning up. And that's, you know, very much consistent with what I think it is fair to say is now the consensus, both among practitioners and researchers, that housing first strategies are the ones that are most likely to be successful, right? It used to be, and, you know, when I first started doing work in soup kitchens and food pantries in New York in the 90s, it was still sort of during a period in which I think probably a majority of shelters, if you had substance abuse issues or a regular user of alcohol, you had to get clean and sober before you could get a bed. And what the research now tells us is that people can't get clean and sober if they don't have a roof over their heads, right? We've got to sort of create some stability for folks and find some ways in which we can build trust with people who may be living on the streets for what to them are perfectly rational reasons, to build trust with them and service providers who historically have often been very unwelcoming, right? The shelter, you know, closes at 7 a.m. You have to go out into the street and you can't come back until closing at night and have to reapply, right? Do you see more global cities adopting those kinds of approaches where it is less, where it is more carrot and more stick, to be crude about it? More carrot and less stick, excuse me.
Yeah, absolutely. We should recruit you for your expertise. So the two stories of the cities that Tamru mentioned where there was success, Edmonton and Houston, both have what they call housing first and what some in the international world often they call housing-led solutions to homelessness. And just as you stated, these started with experiments in New York City dealing with some of the toughest candidates on the street with mental illness, substance abuse, and so forth, and placing them directly into housing in communities and finding out that that worked for them, that they actually did okay, and that it was a cost-effective way of treating them. And that has since then been applied to other populations as well, and with an understanding that you don't have to get people sort of housing ready in order to get them into housing, that many people, there's still some who will need more resources, but many people, the solution to homelessness is housing. And if given that, they will do well.
So what I will turn it back to you, Tamru, as we wind down in our conversation here today. What have we not touched on that we should? What are the messages that you want to leave listeners with as they perhaps think about problems of housing insecurity and homelessness in their own cities? What are the lessons Sure. that you would encourage them to take away?
I would not, although I think we should say that the mayors don't control all the levers. I kind of like the pressure that people place on the mayors. I think the idea of forcing someone to take on leadership in terms of finding strategies to address this crisis is really important. But I think people also have to be critical of the national government, the federal government in the United States, and national government outside of the United States,
and state governments countries. For that matter,
state governments and as well, exactly. And so I think people have to if you're gonna just pressure your most local leader, well that's fine, but I think that you also have to advocate at a national level, and in the United States we really don't have true ownership of the issue of homelessness. I mean, HUD tends to distribute many of the housing resources, but in many countries you kind of see that. You see that no one wants to own this issue. So actually advocating for someone to own and actually strategically plan to address it, it's not a crazy idea. It can be done, and so that's the second thing. It can be done, and actually one thing I think that we learned through COVID is that when people want to invest resources to bring people off the streets, they find a way to do it. And this was a crisis that existed before COVID, and so many cities and so many countries have had this amazing impact of bringing more people in recent history off the streets. And now they can't lose this opportunity, and they should use this engagement, this opportunity to engage people who are brought off, whether it's into hotels or other shelters or temporary housing. Use this opportunity to transition people into permanent housing, and so that's what I would say. Like you no one wants to send people out back to the streets, but we know. And we've shown that you could actually do something when you,
decide to do it.
Yep, when you decide to do it.
Jay, final word to you.
Yeah, I mean, this is a polarizing issue. We're in a divided country. We do want to bring some hope. So we're not naive. You know, we know how hard the work is, but we want people to know it's not hopeless. That, you know, there are strategies that are working, and we hope to move the social service approaches forward and address this better. We've seen it done. And also that the proceeds of this book will go to BRC, by the way. So all of the proceeds of the book will go to a nonprofit organization that's addressing homelessness.
That's actually doing the work.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking today with Jane Bainbridge and Tamaru Mamo, who are the co-authors, along with Linda Gibbs and Muzzy Rosenblatt, of How 10 Global Cities Take on Homelessness, Innovations at Work, from the University of California Press. Jay, Tamaru, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.